You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, as India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi starts his five-day trip to three island nations, we'll ask if Sri Lanka is looking to India over China. Also ahead...
I think it's somewhat ironic to see some members of Congress wanting to make common cause with the hardliners in Iran.
Republican senators try to interfere with Iran's nuclear talks, but will a letter actually change anything? Plus, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko claims the pullback of heavy weapons has started, and the United States put sanctions on Nicolas Maduro's Venezuela. To analyse all that and much more besides, I'm joined by our guests today. Kathleen Burke and John Everard will be here with their take on the day's news. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. This is Midori House coming to you live from London. The time here is 1401 in New York City. Joining me with their take on the news here in studio are both Kathleen Burke and John Everard. We'll be hearing from them in just a moment. First, a couple of the big stories that have caught our eye this day. Pro-Russian rebels have withdrawn from what's been described as a significant amount of heavy weapons from the east of Ukraine. According to Ukraine's president, Petro Poroshenko, troops from Chad and Niger have seized two towns in northern Nigeria from the militant group Boko Haram, part of an African Union response. Venezuela has reacted angrily to a US decision to expand sanctions against several key government officials and declare the country a national security risk. And in Seoul, the US ambassador to Korea has been released from hospital following a knife attack last week. Mark Lippert said he was feeling pretty darn good. And those are some of the stories that have caught our eye today. Let's get the view on, well, some of those stories and others from both Kathleen Burke, who's a professor of modern and contemporary history at University College London, and John Everard, a former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. We'll kick off this edition of Midori House by looking to the US, the ever-delicate US-Iran relationship, again making the headlines, this time over a letter sent by a group of senators to Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. 47 US Republican senators, led by Tom Cotton, a junior senator for Arkansas, sent a letter reminding Zarif of how any deal is just an executive agreement until it gets congressional approval. Obama described the move as unusual coalition with Iran's hardline religious leaders, whereas Iran's foreign minister talks about a propaganda ploy and a method unprecedented in diplomatic history. John Everett, perhaps I'll start with you. The White House and Obama, indeed, are outraged about this. Are they right to be, in your view?
Yes, quite simply. What the senators have done is, if not unprecedented, certainly very rare. The general idea is, in the United States, as in most countries, that the government conducts international relations, consulting the legislative powers as required. And for a group of senators to write directly to a foreign country at any time, and certainly to a foreign country with which the United States is enmeshed in very delicate and very complex negotiations, is, simply put, not clever. Catherine and I were discussing this just before we came on air. They seem to have made something of a mistake in the advice they're giving the Iranians. It is not for the Senate formally to ratify a treaty. The President of the United States does that with the advice and consent of the Senate. Now, the difference may be a bit technical. In practice, the only real difference is that means that if the Senate says, yes, we like this treaty, the President can still say, actually, no, I'm not going to sign it after all. But in a letter supposedly giving the Iranians a lesson on the workings of the American Constitution, it was a silly mistake to make.
Well, I mean, Kathleen, let me ask you about that. I mean, how much of a damning indictment is it of the understanding of process and, you know, not just the sort of the rights and wrongs in terms of the sort of etiquette of it, but fundamentally, if there are sort of technical misunderstandings, that doesn't show these co-authors of this letter in a very good light, does it?
No. Well, Harry Reid, the minority leader in the Senate, pointed out that this junior senator, who only became a senator 62 days ago, has issued a statement of such pettiness that it brings the United States abroad into disrepute. whilst Cotton was sitting there, Senator Cotton was sitting there presiding over the chamber at that particular time. I would have loved to have seen that one. And the problem about treaties, remember, the U.S. hasn't actually had a treaty of war, which is what they're more or less implying that we are with it, that the United States is at war with Iran since the Second World War. So that's neither here nor there. There are jillions of executive agreements between any given president and anyone else. And the idea that somehow someone coming into office in 2 or 3 years' time, if this is actually agreed, is going to upturn it if it seemed to be working, is just ridiculous. I mean, not only do they not understand international procedure, but they don't realize, they mustn't realize, the impression they're giving of an adult political process from the United States. I mean, if we want to talk about dysfunctional political systems, I very much regret to say we're going to have to start looking pretty seriously at the United States.
I wonder, John, I mean, is it a misunderstanding then of procedure, or is it a willful ignorance of it, or is it a calculated, you know, ignorance of it? Do you think it's a question of a lack of knowledge, or is there a wider point that some of these co-authors are trying to make here?
I don't think that this was calculated, although it's just possible it might be. I think this was simple ignorance, that they've shown themselves up to be not quite au fait either with the United States Constitution or with the way that international diplomacy works. Putting it very simply, they've made fools of themselves.
Kathy, it's interesting that Obama's policy on this point has drawn bipartisan criticism. There's no point pretending otherwise. But the letter was only signed by Republicans. Is that fact alone telling in terms of the, when we look at, you know, motivations, for example?
Well, it's telling in terms of partisan ferocity is what it is turning. If it were truly bipartisan, there would have been Democratic signers. But the idea that you undermine a president negotiating in international relations, I don't know who that the ages or the experience of all of these Republican senators, but it does sound as though it's being led by the leaders of a kindergarten. It is just quite astonishing. It is not done. It is not done constitutionally. It is not done internationally. And I agree wholeheartedly with John. It makes them look like a bunch of fools.
John, I mean, this is a pretty grim prospect, but, you know, as we look ahead to 2016. Should we be prepared for more of this sort of tone, more of this tenor when it comes to how the political discourse is going to sort itself out in the US? Is it inevitable, or should we have loftier hopes for the representative officials there?
I'm always in favour of lofty hopes, but will they do it again? Don't know. I think a lot will depend on the fallout from this incident. If, as I hope, they are all made to feel very, very silly, then I hope that they would learn the lesson and not do it again. But of course, we can't be sure that that is what the outcome will be.
It would be better if we thought it was just the younger senators doing it.
Yes.
But there are an awful lot of experienced senators there, and I can only assume, John may not agree with me, that the partisanship is wholly overborne judgment in this case.
I fear you're right.
Kathy, just one final thought then. Is there any way that this might even play to strengthen the White House, strengthen Obama's hand as he looks to continue to conduct some of these very delicate and tricky negotiations over the next sort of few months or so, given the pressure he was already under domestically? Could this play into his hand somewhat, or does it just make a complicated situation even more complex?
Well, I think that they have so shown themselves up that Obama must come out looking like a grown-up in comparison, that, as he points out, as we pointed out with Netanyahu last week, what is the alternative?
Well, a pregnant silence there speaks volumes. Let's move on to our next story. India's Prime Minister has started his 5-day trip to the Seychelles, Sri Lanka and Mauritius to boost economic ties with the three island nations. Modi's the first Indian Prime Minister to make a bilateral visit to Sri Lanka in over 2 decades. In an effort, many observers suggest, to balance China's growing imprint in the region. John, a sort of island-hopping trip, I must say, it sounds rather agreeable. But what's at the heart of this? Is there an awareness from Modi you know, and his government that, you know, there is this sort of spectre of China, and that there needs to be quite a lot of diplomatic sort of work done to make sure that things unfold in a way that's agreeable to them also?
I think that India's relations with China are there in the background. I mean, India will be concerned to have good relations with countries in effectively its own backyard. But I think it's more than that. If you go back to Modi's inauguration speech, he talked a lot about the economy, and all that was reported in great and gory detail right across the world's media. He also talked about foreign affairs, and I can't now recall his exact words, but it was to the effect that he was going to work to quell disputes in the neighbourhood. And nobody paid much attention to this at the time, but lo and behold, here he is apparently doing just that. He is trying to rebuild a relationship with Sri Lanka, a country which, of course, is geographically very close to India, but with which India has had complex relations for a very long time, not least, of course, over the vexed Tamil issue. And also reaching out to the Seychelles, with which India doesn't have big problems, but which has been feeling, I think, rather neglected by India in recent years. Interesting that he didn't include the Maldive Islands this time round. There was talk of the Maldives being included in the tour. They're not on his itinerary, I suspect simply because he couldn't fit them in, but watch out for a future visit there in future.
Maybe he's just saving up that one for when he needs another little breather in the sunshine somewhere. It's interesting, though, isn't it, Catherine, looking at this sort of... It's an interesting battleground, if you will, the sort of Indian Ocean. What do you think the key narratives are? Are they about Modi, as John says, playing this sort of statesman-like figure, almost a bit of a, I don't know, regional policeman almost? Or are there other... Is it always this sort of the Chinese question that will lurk in the background, do you think?
Well, I'm a strategic sort of woman myself, and I think the Chinese thing is extremely important. Sri Lanka really set things up. It's not just, as John quite rightly points out, the long-standing opposition between them. But the last prime minister, Rajapaksa, Paksa, I think, was a very close ally with China. And I think Modi was a bit upset last year when a Chinese submarine called at Sri Lanka, you know, a particular port twice. It wasn't just about economics, as China had been saying, this great, Silk Road of the Sea route, where they can then expand their economics. China and India, we must remember, have fought wars. 1962, there was a border conflict. We look at a map and we see India on the left, and then we see China right around on the right, and we forget that at the top they meet. You know, there's border conflicts there. And India has let it go by default, I think, is the feeling now, that she has not exercised herself in a way that she ought to if she is going to be a regional superpower, as she obviously intends to do. And it's interesting to me as well, at the various places where he's stopping, he isn't offering, like China does, £1.5 billion towards a port. He offers things that don't cost much but have symbolism, a coastal radar, you know, for example, which means a lot to a country of 90,000 people, but costs very little. So it's interesting to me as well that he can't compete with China's resources in that way. So he's doing things that are almost fitted to the scope of the countries he's visiting, but will mean a lot in those individual places.
So, John, do you think that this is as much about sort of defense, it's as much about strategic defense as it is about, you know, strengthening economic relationships?
Yes, I do. I think this is both strategy and economics. And we need to remember that it comes at a time when Indian GDP growth has just overtaken China's, a symbolically very important moment, which will doubtless have caused Modi a great deal of satisfaction. Also at a time when China is showing significant imperial overstretch. We've seen China pick fights with, you name it, Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines, Indonesia, I mean, over a whole range of islands, and then this year draw its horns in, realizing that it had gone too far, that there was a danger that its bluff was going to be called. And so here now we see India moving in into the strategic space where China's will to dominate may be flagging, rather, at a significant moment in the balance of power between the two countries.
I just wanted to say one thing interesting here is traditionally China, the Chinese Empire, was able to control because of the huge manpower. Nowadays, of course, the manpower means zilch unless you can get it someplace. And so what China is actually devoting itself to at this point, besides, of course, trying to train its army a bit better, is means of power projection. You can't fight a country if you can't get your soldiers over there. So controlling its coastline and the straits and so forth, where you're going to put these through, I think is where China is not pulling itself back when you think the number of submarines they're building this year, for example. But I agree with John, obviously, that it's all of a sudden realized it can't do everything it wants to do, and there's going to have to be some executive decisions taken.
The insights of Kathleen Burke and John Everard, both still with me on Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll assess if heavy weapons are actually being pulled back from Ukraine, ask what prompted the US to declare Venezuela a national security threat, and hear why North Korea will be looking closely to the skies over the next month. Stay tuned.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, a program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, now off to Venezuela, where alleged human rights abuses have caused the US to put sanctions on seven government officials in the most serious bilateral diplomatic dispute since President Nicolas Maduro took office in 2013. The US has also declared Venezuela a national security threat, the first step when starting a sanctions program against a country. Will this actually make any difference on the ground? Let's hear what the Latin American commentator, friend of Monocle 24, Oscar Guardiola Rivera, had to say a little earlier.
It is unhelpful insofar as it gives the Venezuelan government what it needs in order to keep arguing that some of the problems which are taking place in Venezuela, some of which are of its own making, can be blamed on the Americans.
Interesting insight there. I saw you, Kathleen, nodding away there. Do you think that Oscar's kind of got to the heart of the matter there, or is there any sort of element to which the US actually does feel endangered in some way by Maduro's Venezuela?
I must say, I'm going to do what a commentator ought never to do and declare total bemusement about the whole thing. Why the United States should declare Venezuela, which can hardly run itself at this point, a national security threat, there must be something going on that I just don't see, especially, I mean, they've come together now with Cuba, which, of course, is Venezuela's great ally. One might have thought they could use Cuba to somehow try to, soften the edges with Venezuela if they wanted to. So John may have, as a Latin American specialist, some ideas on this, but from the outside, it looks incomprehensible.
I think Oscar's right. I think it's unfortunate, and I think it will give Maduro an excuse, someone to blame the Venezuelans' problems on, that he will exploit remorselessly. We've already seen the first instance of this in the two-hour thunderous speech that he addressed to the nation as soon as these measures were announced. I don't know exactly what has prompted this. I suspect that the US administration simply came under pressure to do something, anything, about the recent human rights abuses in Venezuela and about the crackdowns on dissidents. I can't help thinking that given the range of policy options that Washington must have had, this probably wasn't the one to go for. And I suspect that part of the answer may be in the speed with which Capriles, you know, the opposition leader, has come out to endorse what President Obama has done. Was this actually being driven by the Venezuelan opposition for their own purposes? We may never know.
But one can imagine that. But the idea that Venezuela is a national threat to the United States is the aspect of I just do not understand. Human rights abuses, yes, all that sort of thing, entirely acceptable and comprehensible. But the idea that the president can announce that Venezuela is a national threat is just risible.
Yes, I agree.
Let's look to Ukraine briefly next. President Petro Poroshenko has confirmed the pullback of heavy weapons in the east. A ceasefire appears to be taking hold despite continuing clashes. Yesterday, Ukrainian military officials reported an offensive near Mariupol by Russian-backed militants. Kathleen, this has been a story of claim and counterclaim. Should we be surprised anymore when we do get these conflicting reports, when we get news of progress in one respect and then setbacks in another? Or do we just need to gear up for, I don't know, more of the same for what could be many more months even?
I mean, fog of war. That's what one always gets when you don't have, you know, BBC people right on the ground telling us what is actually happening. It does make one wonder whether Putin does have control over those on the ground. If you've got guns being pulled back, as they've said, you know, to have their 30 kilometers on each so that you can't actually reach the opposing lines if you fire them off, if that's been done, why should he want, what does it do for Putin to allow, if he can allow, these sorts of spurts out from the edges? Is he going to say, I'm sorry, I'm not strong enough to be able to control my men on the ground? I don't think so. So one just does think it might be, you know, you try to ride a dragon, but then there's little dragons that come out and you can't control them all. So no, we don't know really what's going on entirely. We don't know why this is happening. I tend to think we're back to fog of war here and right hand's not doing what left hands are doing.
John, would you sort of go along with that, or do you see anything amongst this fog, amongst this confusing picture that suggests there could be some form of workable endgame here?
I think that there are three possible explanations, very, very broadly, about what is going on. Firstly, that the ceasefire is holding and that the heavy weapons are being withdrawn and that all that we're seeing around Mariupol is a minor skirmish by, I don't know, rogue elements, but yet that it will die down. That is the optimistic scenario, if you like. Scenario number two, that the ceasefire at the strategic level is holding, but that Putin does not have complete control over the rebel elements. There have been a lot of indications that a lot of the decisions being made in East Ukraine are being made there in Donetsk and Luhansk, not in Moscow, and that although Putin can issue general directives, some of the thugs on the ground will just ignore them. So that what we're seeing is an observed ceasefire along a lot of the line, but the guys at Mariupol are waging their own private war. Now, what happens in that scenario then depends entirely on just what resources they can bring to bear. So far, the Ukrainian line appears to be holding, and it's quite possible that this will just peter out and the ceasefire will survive. Third scenario is that Putin has got this all worked out, and that what he is doing is withdrawing his heavy weapons back from the front lines in the north to redeploy them for an all-out blitz on Mariupol when they are in position, and that what we are witnessing around Mariupol at the moment is a probing exercise while they test the Ukrainian defences. I very much hope that isn't the case. The more I see of Putin's government, the more I am tending to doubt that something quite so complicated could come out of what is actually quite a primitive and almost simplistic organism, but it is possible that that is what's going on.
I wonder, I mean, that's an interesting point, Kathleen. You know, is there a tendency, is it too easy, we too quick perhaps in, you know, the West, talking broadly, to credit Putin with having a machine capable of these sorts of cunning calculations? Or is it just too easy to paint him in that light, whereas in fact the situation may be that he's as confused as many of the other people who are on the ground, you know, within this sort of theater?
Well, if that Putin wants to be seen as the man who is in control, I mean, that's the whole point of his position, surely. Well, it reminds me briefly of when Eisenhower was general of the armies, and when Harry Truman came in to as president, and he said, Harry is going to say, do this, and Eisenhower is going to say, do this, and nothing is going to happen. Because you can will it. You can will the end, but you can't will the means. And I think it's just going to be an appalling mess for some time. People are going to get killed. There's not going to be any obvious outcome at this point. I don't think Mariupol can be Putin's goal quite so quickly. It makes no sense to do it quite so quickly. But the end game must be in due course if he can do it.
A situation we'll have to watch very carefully. Let's move on just before the end of the show and talk a little about the interview. This might once be again the centre of a diplomatic row, this time between North and South Korea. A group of South Korean activists have announced they will launch by balloon over North Korean territory 10,000 copies of this movie that just seems to keep on coming back for more, alongside 500,000 propaganda leaflets. Pyongyang's already reacted, threatening the group leader, saying he'll pay for his crimes in blood if the copies enter their territory. Just how much damage could something like this actually do within North Korea, John? You've got a deep understanding of this. Again, do we blow these things out of proportion, or, you know, can it have the sorts of impact that one would perhaps like to imagine when reading these sorts of stories?
I think sending materials into North Korea, if you get the right materials to the right people, can have an impact. The Interview is an absolutely lousy film. I mean, it is so bad, it's almost comical for that reason. That's what it looks like to us. To an ordinary North Korean, not used to the subtleties of Western cinema, it will just look like pure junk. And I very much doubt if the few who will actually get to see it will have their minds changed against Kim Jong-un at all by doing so. The fun thing to watch is going to be how many of the balloons that are going to be launched on March 26, apparently, how many of the balloons the North Koreans actually managed to hit this time. Remember that last time round, October the 14th, they machine-gunned this great sort of volley of balloons and missed all of them.
It's interesting, Catherine. I know you've spent time as well, you know, sort of, you know, in Korea. Do you get a sense from your experiences there, and I guess from just reading around this, about the kind of impact this could have, aside from, you know, the game, intriguing game of watching the attempted strikes on the balloons by the North Korean sort of infantrymen? What kind of difference could this make, if any? Do you think, again, it's just a great story for the media to kick around, and maybe that the substance of it is, you know, pretty insignificant?
Well, one wonders how it's going to get to people. One wonders what machines they have actually to watch or play them. I think the propaganda leaflets, well, John will know better than me. He's been to North Korea substantially. Whether that makes any difference, if it makes any difference, can they do anything about it? I think this is at least as much a propaganda ploy for the rest of us to show that something is happening and something is being done. But also, it also sends up the North Koreans yet again. First, this ridiculous film, and secondly, a ridiculous opposition to it.
John, what's your best guess? Very, very briefly, will enough people watch this, if any, to actually change anything on the ground? If only they'll learn that maybe American satire isn't all it's cracked up to be.
No, I doubt that they will. And I think it's a great pity that they were using all these balloons, expensive balloons, to get, you know, such a bad film in. With that kind of penetration, there's a lot of things you could get into North Korea that would make a difference, but not The Interview.
There you go. The verdict of John Everard and Kathleen Burke, my guest today here on Midori House. That's just about all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Carlotta Ribello. Our researchers to David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant, and our studio manager, Wei Dong Lin. For the next half hour, Marcus Hippie will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900 hours, it's Section D with Tom Morris, and at 2200, more great news, analysis and reviews on the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24. This show's back at the same time tomorrow, as if you needed reminding, 1800 hours, London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, and my guest, that's all we've got time for. Thanks very much for listening.